The Universal Remedy by Jan van Rijkenborg. Chapter 1. Many are called, but few are chosen. Matthew 22:14. Since the beginning of this century, the world has sped at an ever more alarming rate towards a definite decision which will finally decide the fate of mankind. You no doubt know that a number of world powers, as well as some smaller groups, are very concerned about the nature of this decision. This is seen in literature and in the immense struggle between the world's ruling powers. In the latter half of the last century, the opinion prevailed that the major conflict of world and mankind consisted in the controversies between capital and labor, between poverty and affluence. You know the enormous commotions which resulted from this, and how thoroughly they changed the aspect of the world. Among the Western peoples who, in recent history, have predominated on Earth until now, these contrasts have practically disappeared, for more and more there is evidence of a social and cultural supersaturation, with all the ensuing consequences and difficulties. Yet when we think of the awakening of the other races, it will become clear to us that these too will, before long, possess everything the Western race has acquired, and people will more and more urgently ask themselves whether these attainments are really blessings. At the same time, fear is increasing at a frightening rate, for in the field of the great socio-economic contrasts, the Western nations have not made themselves particularly beloved of the other races. We may rightly wonder what the colored peoples will do with us, the Western race, when once they have achieved the same socio-economic and cultural results, including all the weapons, airplanes, rockets, and atomic destruction units. May we use an example? The Chinese already have a number of universities with Chinese professors who received their scientific education in Western universities. They hand their Western knowledge on to tens of thousands of young people, exactly as has happened in Russia since 1917. Many of these young people have meanwhile finished their studies, and in the near future, large numbers of doctors will start practice in every kind of faculty. China is already in possession of nuclear weapons and rockets too, and all the basic materials for a worldwide economy are at hand, in Tibet and the Gobi especially. So now the burning question is, what are the Chinese going to do with us? From a dialectical viewpoint, it seems understandable when people say, let us do something to them while there is still time before they do something to us. Others react against this urgent suggestion, saying, for God's sake, don't start violence. It's already too late for such a thing. Look what happened in Korea and Indochina. It would be the end of everything and everybody. So more clearly than ever before, we discern two governing powers separated into two world-spanning camps. When we take off all the glitter, the basic reality is that one governing power draws its strength from the so-called guided economy, and the other, until now, from what is called free enterprise. Both systems have their advocates and opponents, but even so, neither system will ever surpass the experimental stage. Confusion is great everywhere, for both large camps shift in the various aspects of world economy, depending on what is useful or necessary for one group of interests or another. At any rate, both camps say, we are the free world, in the other, you live in abject slavery. Both camps are armed to the teeth and are an enormous threat to one another. Consequently, neither of them can allow the other any concessions, as any concession might disturb the balance. There is but one possibility for either of them, always to search for new means of power, which finally will make their power absolute. It is a lugubrious game to which mankind is subjected, mankind in whom such immense possibilities are stored. What a terrible danger it has entered. Everybody lives in fear of everybody else. All distrust each other. A pool of ever-increasing hatred, fear, worry, and anxiety has become mankind's atmosphere of life during this century. Into this poisonous respiration field, four generations have already entered. Thus, we need not be surprised when we hear about the horrible consequences of such living conditions. The physical conduct of the governing groups, with all its etheric, astral, and mental ramifications, has created a state of being much more terrifying, disastrous, and deadly than anything else this century has given us to see and experience in the form of wars, namely, a hellish respiration field, an inferno in which all the energies of the reflection sphere intermingle with mankind. What was announced previously as a threat has now become a reality which causes a very dangerous psychic disorder in all the growing generations. It is no exaggeration to say that mankind is rapidly on its way to becoming sick in the soul. When mankind is forced to live and breathe in a very poisonous atmosphere, then, naturally, the same is true for the other kingdoms of nature. The vegetable and animal kingdoms inhale the poisonous influences of the extremely filthy and ruinous ethers and astral radiations just as we do. Anyone who takes food is affected under the very soul fluids. So we may rightly say that nobody can escape, nobody can avoid psychic destruction. It affects the younger generations especially, and will do so to an ever-increasing extent until finally there will appear a generation that, in its ways of expression, will put the prehistoric Lemurians to shame should one start to compare them. Under the guidance of its authorities, mankind has maneuvered itself into an abyss, and the great powers of the world prevent it from climbing out, just as happened in prehistoric times. As in Atlantis, for example, we said that mankind is becoming fundamentally sick in the soul. What do we mean by this? Well, every nature-born person possesses by nature an animating power from which life and consciousness can be explained, this natural or animal consciousness, and all of. The animating power connected with it are, on the one hand, explainable from heredity, and on the other from karmic factors. We received our natural consciousness, the power which animates us, from our parents and ancestors, and the microcosm which surrounds us transfers to us the microcosmic past. Furthermore, our life is made possible and maintained by means of our breath, that is, by the life atmosphere which is around us. We know there is an interaction between man and atmosphere. Our parents are responsible for the atmosphere which surrounds us. We can improve this atmosphere or make it fatal. Our children develop similar possibilities until a situation arises which makes life impossible for nature-born man. The nature-born body, the nature-born soul, and the nature-born life have but one principle and fundamental purpose: to maintain and keep open the possibilities for rebirth as long as possible. The nature-born body is an instrument for the attainment of a higher and more perfect life. When we damage its functions, when we prevent its animating power from developing naturally, when we force it to live in a poisonous respiration field, the result will be a psychic disablement. More and more, this will, in its consequences, escape any control and will finally bring forth over all the world a population of absolutely abnormal beings. Every new generation will show the effects of this abnormality more distinctly. To what extent this condition of ultimate distress has already been reached, you can see for yourself. The pupils of the spiritual school, the Lectorium Rosicrucianum, know that this severe danger and its consequences can only be averted for many when those who want to and are able to do so start positively to go the path of soul rebirth, and when they are able to make use of a purified alchemical field of transmutation which differs sharply from the poisonous respiration field of the masses. The spiritual school maintains such a sanctified transmutation field which can remain alive when a group of truly new living people maintains it. Should such a group weaken in power and capacity, it would no longer be able to resist the poison surrounding it. The field of transmutation would crash down, and the spiritual school would no longer be able to do its work. Only the name would remain. The task of the school can be executed only when it possesses a group that will give evidence that it really has the required qualities. It is necessary that we tell you this with great emphasis, for every negative endeavor to stop the nations in their downward course will prove completely futile. Our century has already given proof of this several times, and the future will prove it still more. The important thing is that we gain insight into the fact that only by practicing the new attitude of life can one realize the fundamental purpose of the nature-born body, and that only by the result of this can one be active in helping, serving, and redeeming mankind, and of course, in achieving self-liberation. Everything a man might possess by virtue of natural birth, such as ambitions, humanitarian feelings, intellectual insight, and so on, is of no use when we wish to do something liberating for mankind. Only a new faculty, awakened by a purposeful attitude of life, will be of any help. You know the words, many are called, but few are chosen. This means all are called to realize the one and only purpose by utilizing the existing possibilities through attitude of life. When we fail in this, it is due not to the call to the possibilities or to the purpose, but exclusively to the neglect of the new attitude of life. He who is willing to perform this work of realization becomes a worthy pupil of the spiritual school in the service of world and mankind.